This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, it is 4:32, so we'll go ahead and call this March 22nd meeting of the University Assembly to order. I'd like to welcome everyone and have Casey begin with our roll call. Oh, okay. Good luck with which button it is. I always struggle.
Ian
Axel.
Here.
Valerie
Anner. Here.
Here on the Zoom.
Mark Zenda. Here. Bishop Benson.
Here.
Stephen Kidding.
We'll be late, excuse.
Steve DeRosa.
Also late, excuse.
Steve Fett. Orson Fortenberry.
Here.
Thomas Fox.
Here.
Preston Hanley.
Here.
Dave Kreider.
Present.
Deborah Howell.
I'm here.
Carolyn Levine.
He's here on the Zoom. Excuse. Okay. All right. With that, we'll move on to our land acknowledgement here. Cornell University is located on the traditional homeland of the Gaigon or the Cuban Nation. The Gaigon are members of the Dana-Shawnee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations within historic and contemporary presence on this land. Confederacy preceded the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaigon dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaigon people, past and present, to these lands and waters. With that, then, we'll move to a call for any late additions to the agenda.
Brandon, it's Deborah. I had sent Jacob something yesterday. I don't see it on the agenda. I was wondering if there just wasn't room and I should save it for next time or if it was missed.
Jacob is not here to answer that question. I will say we have a very full agenda that I don't know that we'll get to all of.
Okay. You know what? I'll save it. And since it's on behalf of the Campus Welfare Committee, if there's any time, I'll just mention it then.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. And I would recommend a motion to make a slight adjustment to the agenda on the open forum item A to state that that is an informal presentation titled Academic Freedom, Global Hubs, and Cornell University's Involvement in the People's Republic of China. And if you were to want to make a motion to do so, you could just say so moved so as to not have to repeat it.
Yes, Richard. So moved.
Richard has made that motion. Do I have a second for that motion? Seconded by Ian. All right, we'll make that adjustment to the agenda. With that, we'll move on to the approval of the meeting minutes. Do we have any motions to approve or amend the meeting minutes from the 2:22 meeting?
Motion to approve.
We have a motion to approve from Richard, seconded by Thomas. Any opposition? Seeing none, those meeting minutes are approved. All right, with that, we'll move into our open forum. And I'll turn it over to Richard Benzel, who will talk about that.
Yeah, just briefly, this is basically just an announcement that we are in the preliminary stages of planning for this teach-in. It is an informational as opposed to, Jake sort of misunderstood when we were putting the agenda together. But it is an informational teach-in, and it is intended to explore and reveal, discuss, interpret some of the implications of Cornell's increasing involvement in the People's Republic of China. And as you probably know from last week, 2 days after the meeting, almost 2 weeks ago, after the last meeting at the University Assembly, on March 10th, there was a session in the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs, in which their congresswoman was presenting to the students there, and a Uyghur woman stood up and said, "Why doesn't Cornell protest conditions in Xinjiang with as much fervor and passion and commitment as it does the invasion of Ukraine?" That freedom of speech happened is 80-some students walked out. Some of them were quite abusive to the Uyghur woman. And they walked out in protest. That is freedom of speech. The harassment is not. And the question, one of the questions we will explore today that depends on the participants is why Cornell's increasing involvement mutes responses to things like that. It turns out that the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs, almost half the students in that MP, in that master's program, are from the People's Republic. It is a big money raiser for Cornell University. So there are very good reasons why the university would mute a response to a protest by these students who were quite united in what they did. And they walked out as a unit under what looked like direction. But anyway, if this happens in Ithaca, imagine what happens in Peking University in Cornell's involvement in Global Hubs and joint degree programs. But we don't want to talk about this. We want to explore it. This should be a public issue. And that's really the announcement. One of the parts of this announcement, if you would like to be part of the mailing list for information on this, let me know, because we're putting together a mailing list, and at some point we'll be asking for volunteers and so forth to distribute posters. And if you know anybody who has artistic talent, we would like to be in touch with them in these posters. So that's it.
Thank you, Richard. Any questions for Richard?
You know what recourse the school took with regard to the students who were actually harassing the Muslim student?
What recourse? Probably none. What you would be looking for in something like that is some recognition of the imbalance between one woman presenting her own view and 80-some students the other side. If you don't preserve order and decorum, and in such a situation, it looks a lot like intimidation. And that the real problem, I think, in this case, is not so much the students, though they should be reprimanded, but they should be told what the proper etiquette would be. But really, the university, it's their job to keep that.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for the question, James. Any other questions for Richard? All right. Seeing none, we'll move up onto the next item here, upcoming visits. I did confirm another one as well on the 29th, the meeting next week. We have a back-to-back meeting just because of the way the calendar works. Next week, we'll have a presentation coming from University Relations on some of the financial impacts of Cornell University and contributions to the community. And then on the 12th, if you wanted to speak to that one, Jacob, by turn.
Yeah, we will be having a
believe, graduate school trustee, graduate student trustee, Liz Davis Frost, coming to discuss an initiative that has been explored and actually was initiated a few years back with women's hygiene products in the bathrooms across campus. And so they're coming to discuss that with us as a potential infrastructural and well-being initiative.
So those will be coming up soon. With that, I want to move on to our business of the day and welcome to the University Assembly here, University Landscape Architect David Cutter, here to talk to us a little bit about signage at the university.
Great. Thank you. As you said, as I'm getting ready to share a screen here, I'm University Landscape Architect here, been here on campus for approximately 15 years at this point. So I'm housed in our facility services within the office of the university architects in a campus planning office. So that's who I am and we're at here anyway. And yes, here to talk about signage and wayfinding, and really kind of the starting point for talking about signage wayfinding is a master plan that actually we did maybe 2016. So it's been a few days, right? And this master plan, you can actually find and you can download it from our own FCS webpage. It's on kind of under the University Architect's Office under Plans and Studies. And you can see the link to it here. But it was really developed as a thinking about an integrated way of signs, of maps, and other wayfinding tools, specifically for the Ithaca campus here. What we envisioned in this master plan is really kind of it's focusing on the visitor and really on the visitor experience. And we're really thinking kind of the whole complete package, really. It starts with kind of partnering with county and municipal signages to get visitors, direct them to campus. We want to make it clear, right, when you have arrived at campus, offer some personal welcome and guidance if you needed, you know, either at a visitor booth, welcome center, or some key places like that. Directs them to the appropriate visitor parking itself. And of course, once you're out of the car, which is one of our goals, is get them out of the car in the right place as quickly as possible, provide them with some pedestrian oriented signs and maps and other things to help them explore campus and find their way to their destinations and appreciate the campus as well. So that was a 2016 master plan that really came out. You know, since then, you know, quite a few important things have happened. You know, we have done a number of pilot signs out there of various types. And we're testing out some of these guidelines that were put together in the master plan, which really have led us to kind of modify some of the graphic and construction details of the signs themselves. Probably the most recent one you've seen on campus is this, the Feeney Way sign on I guess you would say, right? formerly East Avenue there, which was used to kind of prototype some interpretive signage, as well as thinking about some of the pedestrian directional signages that I'll talk about in a little bit. Of course, another thing that happened since 2016, we now have a real visitor center or welcome center that is now the focus for visitors coming to campus. And so obviously that has kind of slightly shifted some of our thinking about how we want to do signage wayfinding on campus. And of course, we've had more buildings. You know, we've had this whole North Campus residential expansion, which is almost done, we hope anyway. But really, the wonderful thing about this is it really presents a great opportunity to install a whole integrated system of both vehicular and pedestrian signs and maps. It's kind of this first phase of implementing an overall master plan for signage on campus. So really, that's, you know, one of the things we're going to be doing is really implementing signage in this area here, really kind of starting kind of the, you know, that primary approach as you come from the north in the airport in Pleasant Grove, all the way down to that kind of that threshold from North Campus into the kind of central campus there in Thurston Ave Bridge is the area where you're going to be seeing in fairly soon kind of our first phase of signage for there. Thinking, you know, currently there really isn't much in the way of a gateway that marks the entrance to campus when you're coming in on Pleasant Grove. Now this kind of is in the area you see here is kind of what we're thinking about right now, is kind of a real good kind of gateway point as you get onto campus from that direction. And, you know, we recognize that, you know, we do have gateway markers on campus, but they're aging, they're pretty low contrast, and let's say they use fairly unremarkable materials. Our signage master plan, we're really exploring a much more kind of impactful high contrast marker of granite, coupled with other identification banners to kind of mark some of our primary vehicular entries. You know, these type of materials here. Also thinking there's some places where really they're more kind of a pedestrian scale gateway, like if you're coming in from College Town or other areas. So maybe a smaller version of kind of marking that entry onto campus with something that's more geared for pedestrians. Thinking about our existing signage that we have out there, you know, we recognize that it's really accumulated over the years, particularly, you know, our vehicular signage is in a very, let's say, inconsistent manner. And, you know, far as pedestrian signage, we hardly have any at all, quite honestly. So our new vehicular signs that we're proposing here are really much less cluttered. They're raised up higher to improve both the visibility from a vehicle as well as kind of safety of being able to see under. You're not blocking the views from a vehicle. And they really have kind of two types of signs for vehicles. One is, right, the classic directional. How do you get to some of these main places on campus? And others is really helping address parking and trying to come up with a simplified version of who can park where and how to find the right parking, particularly for a visitor anyway. Now, of course, one of the real challenges you have with vehicular signage is you've got a limited amount of real estate on a sign. Now, each sign, we can have maybe 4 or 5 different destinations on there. So we have to be very disciplined in what goes on to a sign, with a focus, again, thinking about, you know, we're getting visitors the information they need to park their car, you know, in the right location and transition to pedestrians as quickly and easily as possible. And then the other challenge we have as well is kind of the actual number of characters, right, you could put on a sign. You can't have a 17-word description of somewhere. We can't write the whole thing, Robert Purcell Community Center. We just don't have that much room on a line. So we have to be very conscious about, you know, what we're calling it and making sure we're consistent as well, where we use abbreviations and names for things. What we use in our signage has to align with what we put on our maps and what we tell our visitors as they're coming onto campus as well. Thinking about pedestrian signs, our pedestrian signs are really kind of a much more narrower profile that really puts that key directional information right there at eye level of a pedestrian, and also includes a more detailed map of the local area. Now, because visitors are going to be closer and able to spend more time at the signs, we can, number one, we can include a lot more destinations on there. And in some areas, we can actually have kind of two panel system, one that tells you about, you know, kind of the area where you are and the destinations to get to some of the nearby ones, but also a second one that gives you kind of the bigger context. Say you're on North Campus, and you can also say, oh, well, if you want to get, you know, South Campus, Central Campus, or other on these areas as well. Another area we're thinking about is how we deal with maps on campus. You may recognize some of the kind of the old maps that we have out here posted in that. And we got maybe a dozen different locations at times. And our current maps we have out there take kind of an everything plus the kitchen sink approach, which can be overwhelming in the amount of detail that you have for a visitor. And the signs are also really quite large. They're pretty much, I guess you would say, more like a vehicular billboard scale, but doesn't really make a lot of sense because you can't use them as a app from a vehicle. They're legible only for a pedestrian. So again, we've also rethought about what that campus maps ought to be. And we're thinking that really, we need two different types of maps. We need one that's kind of a larger regional campus map scaled for pedestrians that provides roughly maybe the top 30 or so visitor destinations on campus. And then we have could also have some of these smaller, what we're calling quad maps, that provides real detailed information about the buildings or other features that are really nearby. So, for example, all the buildings around the Arts Quad or a certain area like that. We're also recognizing that, you know, a lot of people navigate with their phone, including myself. And so we're also going to be adding links to the various online maps that we have available. And just, you know, so you know, and our own campus planning website, you know, we have a whole range of maps there, from accessibility, transportation, dining, historic, even where you can find individual identified trees on campus. So we do have a lot of digital resources that are available out there as well that we can link to. Now, the maps themselves are also being simplified and kind of stylized to help improve clarity and legibility. And I'm sharing this is not necessarily a new style or new colors or anything, but more just thinking about content and, you know, what is the extent of what we would show on there. So we're talking about, you know, starting kind of from the childcare center at the north, down into College Town, kind of campus, West Campus, University Ave, all the way out to the kind of Arboretum in the Botanic Gardens. Noticeably, we're not including going all the way out, or at least right now, we're not going to go all the way out, say, to East Hill Plaza or any of those, some of those research or athletic facilities out there. And, you know, certainly I'd love to hear some feedback about some of that information. The other thing that we're doing on kind of those main maps are really finding and calling out key destinations on campus. And this is kind of proposed what our consultants initially had proposed as kind of the top 30 or so visitor destinations on campus. And they include, you know, the obvious visitor destinations like the Art Museum, Bailey Hall, Sattler Hotel, major athletic event venues, and also include buildings that house the admissions office for each of the colleges as well. So, but some of the things I kind of wonder about as well. So getting some feedback on some of these destinations, I think, would be really useful to me as we go down and continue to develop our some of our maps and these other signage wayfinding components. I will note that, you know, we already have a fairly good building naming and more recently kind of addressing system that we standardized on campus. So we do comply with our 911 emergency service here. Most of them are cast aluminum letters that have the building name and the 911 address posted right on the building itself. And, you know, we're, while not really a permanent type of signage, banners are also another kind of valuable wayfinding tool and provide identity and current information to campus users. You know, banners, we don't really, you know, they're not signs per se. I guess you could say they're temporary signage. And, you know, we've used them for a long time for campus events, you know, such as homecoming and all. But more recently, we're using them more to provide identity to an area, like what we've done in the athletics area to kind of to recognize that, or the law school has done that. And, you know, we're thinking again about, you know, maybe we use those and to help mark kind of the entrance to campus as well. The final sign type that I just want to mention is interpretive panels. And, you know, CALS and, you know, Botanic Gardens in particular have really done a good job of adding signage to kind of help visitors and the community understand and appreciate some of the history or the ecology or other significant contributions of our university or its peoples or the environment. So we have kind of two different types of interpretive panels that we're proposing for across campus. You know, one set that looks a lot like our pedestrian wayfinding signs, which are more of the vertical upright, like what we did on Feeney Way, for example, is one of our pilots. And then one that's more traditional, kind of the low profile horizontal version, that is more like what the Botanic Gardens have been using for years as well. But again, can help provide a different type of visitor information and information about the campus. So just kind of wrapping up, you know, the first phase that we have of implementing signage on North Campus is going to be the vehicular signage. actually is actually going out to bid right now, and we hope that'll be installed sometime this summer. The next phase is going to be the pedestrian aspect of signage on North Campus. And that probably will be following on probably within the next 6 months or thereabouts or so. And just, your information, one of the time-consuming aspects of implementing is really getting concurrence on all that exact work wording or the message, right, that goes on to every sign. So, here's what we had to do just for the vehicular directional signs that are going up this summer. And of course, we see this as a pilot, and so we're planning on incorporating any lessons learned that we get from this phase of implementation here into kind of our new signage standards, and also put them into our design and construction standards. So future projects as well will be able to incorporate new signage standards into their new project documents as well. So I will stop there. I would be really pleased to answer questions or get feedback on any of the aspects that I said. And of course, see, here is my ID, DMC86. If you want to think about some of this and you want to email me or continue a conversation later, I am certainly open to that as well. Oh, but I'm going to actually stop sharing now so I could see as many people as possible anyway, and we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, David. I really like how you made the point of talking about the beauty of campus and how these signs can help people to find those points of interest as they're navigating campus. I think that's a really important aspect of what we have here on campus that I sometimes neglect to take note of. So I appreciate that perspective. So with that, I'll turn it over to the assembly members with questions. And I see Valerie has her hand up first, and I'll turn to Valerie with questions.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hey, Val.
So I was just curious about the signage. Is there any lighting associated with the signage? I mean, can people see these when they're navigating at night? And specifically, the entrance signage is the big granite pieces that you guys are proposing. Is there any lighting involved with that?
The entry signage, yeah, the granite signage are the only ones actually that have lighting incorporated into them. The rest of the signage are all made with, high contrast reflecting letters. So any ambient light should make them fairly visible throughout the night. But no, we're not lighting any of the signs here. We will be using, try to locate them where there is, existing street lights, pedestrian lights, and that type of thing. But they won't have specific lights as part of them.
Thank you.
And Richard had a question.
Yeah, a question, comment. Yeah, you said this is a provisional system of signage, and you like feedback on it. I was wondering, could you incorporate into the sign a notice that, somebody reading the sign, they don't see what they need, so they notify you. And so from that notification, you would know what the sign wasn't conveying that somebody needed to know. In other words, there'd be some kind of feedback that would be incorporated into the sign itself. Because otherwise it seems difficult to get that feedback.
That's a good point. And, maybe there is a way that we can use like a QR code or some other tool like that, say, that would provide an easy way for somebody to provide and collect, feedback on any signs too, without putting a lot of, having to put a lot of information on a sign. But yeah, that's a good idea. And we can also post something on our, our website as well, have a general question there where we could use that to collect feedback as well.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, David. Nick has a question.
Thanks so much, Brandon. And thank you, David. I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes of your presentation, and this question might be totally obsolete, so I apologize in advance. But I'm just wondering, are we at all constrained by the manual on uniform traffic control devices that the federal government and the state have in terms of making this signage, or does that not apply to Cornell because it's like not state property?
Most of the, that's a very good question. We did try to keep that in mind. There are a few locations where it would be ideal for us to locate a sign. You know, for example, Dryden Rose. It is a, you know, it's a state highway, for example. There we would have to be, you know, cognizant of the federal regulations, and we would, you know, we'd have to get permission there. But for the most part, all this signage is really, it's on our property. It's not on, you know, any of designated. So we can more or less, you know, set our own standards. Obviously, you know, federal standards are there for a reason, because, you know, they want to make them legible, they want to make them safe and all. And we clearly are following the reason behind, but not necessarily the exact specifications that they put in there. That answers your question.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions for David? Well, Marcy, and then to Dr.
Hi, David. Yes, my name is Marcy. I work at the Veterinary College, and I've worked there for probably about 20, almost 22 years now. And signage at the Vet College has always been a bit of a challenge for clients to find us. So we did implement those banners to just differentiate, because we have a companion animal hospital and a large animal hospital and in the main entrance. But it looked like the map was not including the Vet College. Is there any plans, if that's not true, is there any plans to update the signage? Because, and again, the signs that are there are the brown on white, which are fading down to brown and light brown. So just wondering about that.
Yeah, so that brings up a good point. So the only, you know, what we're doing on North Campus is really a first phase. And that's the only thing that we have funded for implementation at this point. We would love to do the whole campus, but, you know, we don't have the funds right now, and we've asked several times, and really need to develop, I think, kind of a, you know, ideally a groundswell of people who are asking for that to raise this up to a priority to get this implemented. That's part of, though, why we are doing the North Campus, because our hope is that, you know, people will see this and recognize that we have a really good system here, and, you know, we should have something like this for the whole campus and not just kind of end it at North Campus there. So that's, you know, that's what I'm trying to do as well, is to develop a greater level of support and kind of raise the priority of this is something that we should be doing sooner rather than later. So good question. So certainly we're not, you know, we're not ignoring, you know, the Vet College or any other part of campus. It's just, you know, we were lucky enough to be able to find funding for a first phase of North Campus, and it made a lot of sense because there are so many big changes there, and including, you know, the new Tang Welcome Center and all. So it made a lot of sense to start there. We would love to roll this out across the whole campus, either in additional phases, or, heaven forbid, we could get a windfall, we could do it all at once.
Thank you, David. And for the sake of time, I'll take one more question from Duncan.
This is a short one. I'm just curious how like move-in and events will affect these signage. So obviously, at the beginning of the year, when a bunch of families are rolling in, and friends and loved ones with cars of new students, and they gotta move in their luggage and all that fun stuff. I'm just curious if this is something under your purview and how these signage could be affected by that.
Yeah, so I get two parts to that answer. First of all, you know, recognizing that, you know, this signage is permanent signage, and it's kind of taking in the overall thing. It provides that framework. One of the things that I didn't mention about, you know, particularly our vehicular signage, is that we're actually leaving space underneath where we could add additional signs for temporary events or temporary directions to things, thinking about exactly move in or commencement or reunion or other times where we want to have a place to put directional information. And so we're finding a way that, you know, we're making it so the vehicular sign, directional signs we have, can have temporary additions on them for that. But recognize that, you know, events are short-term things, and, you know, we don't want to have a permanent system that is, you know, it's just like you think about how you size a parking lot at Walmart. You don't, you know, you don't want to put parking there for the day before Thanksgiving or after Thanksgiving, Christmas and all, you try to size things for the normal conditions and then be able to have a plan for addressing these special events. And that's kind of the approach we're taking as well with signage, is that we're looking for signage that addresses the majority of people's needs throughout the year with the ability to add on for events or other special conditions.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, David. I would just encourage everyone here, as David has provided his contact information, to reach out if you have additional comments or questions or feedback. David, is that list of the top 30 or so that you were looking at, is that available that we could send out to folks to give feedback on for you? That seemed like something you were interested in.
Yeah, why don't I put together a couple key slides that you could share out with everybody and send them to you that you can share out with the group to make it easier and you have a reference.
That'd be great, David. Send that over and we'll get that out to everyone. So thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you being here.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity.
Have a good day. All right. With that, we'll move on to the next item in our agenda, which is resolution number 3, increasing the number of sustainable waste receptacles on campus. With that, I will turn that over to the resolution presenters, Ian and whoever else would like to join.
Thanks very much, Brandon. I know we've talked a lot about this the past couple meetings, so I'll be brief and won't go through the whole presentation again. But just in case there's anybody who's not familiar, what this resolution is about is upgrading Cornell's current outdoor waste infrastructure to include smart waste receptacles that monitor how full their contents are, and then signal to Cornell grounds and facilities management when a trash pickup needs to happen. The goal of this resolution has several points. First, to reduce Cornell's carbon footprint by requiring fewer vehicle trips to collect trash. I think the utility of this item is highlighted extensively just based on what we've seen happen to gas prices in the past several weeks. Secondly, this resolution aims to increase the convenience for students, staff, and faculty members. One of the issues with Cornell's current outdoor waste infrastructure is that because of the bin design over the years, a lot of them have been moved, and there's not currently an accurate representation of where all the trash receptacles are. In addition, because of their open nature, animals get into them, which increases the frequency with which Cornell facilities management and grounds have to empty the bins. One of the points I'll highlight from the meeting on February 1st, and for those of you who are able to view the meeting recording, thank you for taking the time. But one of the points that was made by representatives from R5 operations was that a lot of the waste receptacles on campus are not filled up when they're picked up. And as a result, for many of them, Cornell is actually committing more empty plastic liners into its aggregate waste output than the amount of trash that's actually in those bins. So a major goal of this resolution would be able to make the bins more visible in more centralized locations, know where they are, and be able to monitor them so we don't have to make as many trash pickups and we don't end up wasting plastic liners just because of the necessity of preventing odors and animal concerns. Then we can leave those liners in the bins longer. Lastly, a goal of this resolution is to increase Cornell's efficiency. There are a lot of ancillary benefits that come with these smart waste receptacles, one of which is the possibility of actually extending Cornell's outdoor Wi-Fi coverage, since many models have the ability to include a Wi-Fi extension base station in their base, which is solar powered, and can be used to extend Cornell's Wi-Fi network in open spaces where the Wi-Fi network is otherwise patchy. And lastly, because grounds and facilities management are not making as many frequent trips to collect trash and are only going to targeted pickups when those bins are full, this is labor that could be deployed elsewhere and used to augment other projects that Cornell wants to undertake. So those are the nuts and bolts of the resolution. I'll turn it over to my co-sponsors if they have any additional comments.
No, I mean, I think they touched on a lot of key points. I want to also emphasize that the cost is relatively marginal compared to the benefit that we will be receiving. I believe that Ian has a lot of the financial data on this in discussion with folks from various different companies, but it seems like the cost is far lower than we had anticipated when we first proposed the resolution to our delight. And it, of course, it will save, I think, an unquantifiable amount of money, given the fact that we will be reducing fuel costs, reducing labor costs, and it's not just a reduction in labor costs, but it's a more efficient use of labor. So instead of having folks going around campus and collecting empty garbage bags, as Ian had mentioned, they'll be spending their time on more needed projects. But that's all I really wanted to highlight there.
I guess I'll just round it out by saying I think there's been a lot of really great constructive feedback that's come from this. And I don't think we've avoided any of it. I think we've tried to address all of it head on because we really feel passionate about this being a net benefit for campus beautification, for efforts of addressing climate change, for bringing down the costs associated with a lot of concerns raised initially, and also trying to hear from people who have been critical of it. We've heard criticism, I think, on a lot of fronts, and I welcome them to bring up those points if they still feel any sort of reservations, because I think right now we have a really well-crafted resolution, and I think this could really help a lot of people and be a really net positive marker of our campus's commitment to sustainability efforts and a real net positive just in keeping Cornell the great place we all love to live and work.
Thank you, Ian, Jacob, and Duncan. And now I'll turn to the Assembly floor for any questions. And I see Caroline Levine has her hand raised. I'll turn it to Caroline.
Hey, everybody. I apologize. I'm again in a weird Wi-Fi place. I'm in Fez, Morocco now, and so I may knock out at some point. And I also I'm in a hotel, so there's music playing. Anyway, I apologize for all of that. I was so concerned when I heard at the last meeting that the campus sustainability office did not want this resolution to pass that I talked to them at some length, and I just wanted to report on their findings. They do their research. This is one of the, I work closely with them, and I know that they do their research, and so I take them very seriously. And there were a number of objections, and so I myself am not going to vote for the resolution. And I thought I would share the their arguments, which I found persuasive. The first is that the big belly solar trash cans have been used at MIT, Brown, Caltech, and others, and they've all been dissatisfied with the service. They're hard to maintain and clean and offer a lot of high-tech, high-problem type issues for maintenance without good return. And so that's a very major concern. But also, they said there are lots of ways we can and need to improve waste and recycling on campus. But and they had some very specific suggestions about what to do about them. But all the behavioral literature points to the idea that fewer bins and consistency in bins and signage is what best reduces landfill waste and recycling contamination. That was what came directly from the sustainability office. And R5, apparently a couple of years ago, worked with the University Assembly and a student team to figure this out, whether this would be a good use of resources. And that's when they decided that it wouldn't, in fact, be a good use of resources. So I know that there was some sense that people had looked into it, but in fact, the conclusion was that it was not a good use of resources. There, it could, in fact, be great to streamline consistent bins and bin types and signage. That would help a lot. But that is complicated because each unit and college is allowed to purchase and place their own bins. So we have lots of different types of bins and inconsistency across campus. So what the campus sustainability office says is that outdoor bins are not really an issue at all. The bigger areas for improvement are large events, academic buildings, and residential building recycling and back of house waste in labs and dining. So these are just my notes. So paying for new high-tech bins and outdoor bins is not going to help us reduce. What we need is to have actually fewer bins, more consistency in signage. We'd love, they say, to partner with the University Assembly on waste reduction as a goal for campus, but it's not going to be through this particular resolution. So that was what I learned, and that is why I am going to vote against it.
Thank you, Caroline. I'll give the sponsors an opportunity to respond. Ian, go ahead.
Thanks for sharing that, Caroline. And I appreciate it because you raised a couple of good points that I think gives an opportunity to clarify where and why we differ from the Campus Sustainability Office on this. So the first is Big Belly is not the only smart waste receptacle company out there. There are others that could be considered as well. But the core thrust of this resolution and where we differ from the Campus Sustainability Office is that although reducing Cornell's carbon footprint and streamlining the waste management process is a goal of this resolution, it's not the only goal. Convenience is a goal too. You know, the Campus Sustainability Office, although I certainly respect them and I admire the goals they're trying to accomplish, I do think that some of their policies are out of touch from the reality of how most people go about their daily lives. Because if Cornell reduces its own waste footprint and the ability to easily throw waste away on campus, for a lot of people, that is not necessarily going to reduce how much waste they consume themselves. They will find other places to throw away that waste. They might litter it. They might become frustrated. And I think that these policies run the risk of alienating people who would otherwise be eager warriors in the fight against climate change. So part of the mandate of the committee I chair, which is the Committee on Infrastructure, Technology, and the Environment, is infrastructure as well as the environment. And this proposal tried to balance both of those two goals by providing Cornell a green option to reduce fuel costs, to reduce its labor allocation towards dealing with waste, but to also improve the convenience by which its students, faculty, and staff can dispose of their waste. The Campus Sustainability Office has also said that students should order fewer Amazon packages. I think it's completely reasonable to encourage people to combine their Amazon orders into a single Amazon day delivery and reduce those deliveries to the extent that they can, but it is simply unrealistic to expect that students are going to stop ordering things from Amazon if they can't get them elsewhere in Ithaca. And even if they can, the convenience factor is simply too great for a student body that is already overloaded and overwhelmed with intense academics. So many of my co-sponsors have anything else to say on that?
Thank you. And I'll just ask for the sponsors to be mindful of time and if the response was covered to not repeat those.
I won't repeat any additional points Ian said, and I'm going to keep it extremely short because I think what he said is very valuable. I mean, I'd highlight, you know, for starters, the many other universities that had incredible relationships with other companies and technology services provided with that, including Lehigh, Yale, and BU, some of the schools we got referenced to in the conversation initially with Sustainability Cornell and some of these technology providers. As well, as I'll just say, you know, we talked about this with James's point initially. You know, we can build infrastructure for what we hope people will do, or we can build infrastructure for what people actually do. That's kind of part of my motivation for entering into this resolution, was just walking around campus. I think it's disgusting. I think it's shameful. And I agree with a lot of Sustainability Cornell's ambitions, and I respect them wholeheartedly, and I hope to work on them in many future resolutions. I'm just looking at this from an infrastructure and practice perspective right now.
Thank you, Duncan. All right, so I see next we have Valerie, Nick, and then Thomas. So I'll turn to Valerie and let's go ahead, Valerie.
So I have to agree with Caroline on this one. I cannot support this resolution as it stands. I think you guys are overreaching. I do appreciate that you
we need to have a solution to this problem on campus, but I don't think you can dictate to Cornell exactly what they should buy and how, what they should use. I think it's better to suggest that they, you know, do a concentrated study, have some students involved with that, and then come up with an overall ways to improve efficiency, ways to improve the current waste management practices on campus, keeping with what President Pollack and Vice President Molina have expressed. But I do think you guys are overreaching, suggesting specifically that these large waste receptacles be included on campus when, you know, again, there is a whole sustainability office that either has been or will be studying this more deeply and certainly longer and with more emphasis than you as students. And I hate to put it that way, and I know it'll come back and bite me in my butt when I say it. But again, keep in mind, this is their jobs, right? You're here as students. And honestly, you do live here and you work here and you appreciate the campus. But honestly, this is their job. This is what they do. Okay? So again, I think you're overreaching. I think it's a good idea, but I think it needs to be part of a solution and not just part the whole resolution. So I can't support it as it is.
So we have quite a few folks lined up with comments. So I'd like to try to gather a few of those and then come back to the responses. If that's okay with the responses?
No.
You like response?
Yeah, I would just like to respond very quickly. I appreciate your concerns, and I think that the concerns are definitely valid. I want to reemphasize the fact that we believe that we are the most sustainable option here. If you sincerely support sustainability, then you will vote favor of this resolution. If not, then you simply do not support sustainability. We got to call it as it is, in my opinion. I think that, and the reason why we believe that, as we've substantiated time and time again, is because, quite simply, myself and the rest of the sponsors simply don't trust the Office of Sustainability. I have my suspicions that they have their own special interests, monetary interests, and what have you, but they have failed thus far to enact any sort of tangible change when it comes to waste management. And so that's where, in my opinion, and the opinion of the sponsors, the University Assembly ought to step in. Now, I am cognizant of the fact that I don't think that it will produce much substantive change necessarily, but it'll certainly spur a conversation that's necessary. Because without this conversation, there was no ball in play, in my opinion. I don't think that they were even focused on this in the slightest, given the responses to many of the questions in the hearing that we had held.
Thank you, Jacob. I'll turn next to Nick.
Thanks. I'll try to be quick. So I, as a concept, this resolution seems really good. So I, on the topic of, you know, whether this is our job or not, I know that it is for a fact my job to represent the interests of the graduate and professional students who are employees and students at this university. And I know for a fact that as an employee and a student, I have to run from work to class to work and back to class. And my days are completely busy. I need to have a snack at some point. You know, I'll get a granola bar or something. I can't throw my trash anywhere on campus. I end up having a bag full of trash that then I have to dispose at home. So that trash is still going to go somewhere. It's not like it's going to disappear. I would be much happier if I had the convenience of being able to throw it out on campus in a designated receptacle. So I don't think reducing the number of trash cans is good. It's quite alienating. I really agree with what the sponsors were saying about, you know, knowing that the campus goal is to reduce the number of trash cans makes people not want to be environmental warriors. I know that for a fact because I personally experienced that. As someone that's a biologist, I think the environment is really important. But then when I hear all this stuff about, oh, you know, not putting trash cans is going to make you produce less trash, I think it's utterly, you know, not nonsensical. And so I fully agree with the purpose of this resolution. Now, what I will reiterate is the first time I voted against it is because of comments like the sustainability office has a vested monetary interest in whatever. Like, I don't want to support that. I do want to support a resolution that's unbiased and, you know, principled and says, we think that we should have more trash cans for X and Y and Z. But if we're going to go into, you know, the people at the sustainability office are incompetent or have, you know, some kind of vested interest in other things, I don't think I can support this. So I'd like to hear from the sponsor specifically, you know, is this resolution just an unbiased resolution that's saying, hey, we've encountered this problem and this is how we propose fixing it? or is there more to it?
I'll have the sponsor to respond. Ian first.
Thanks, Brandon. So I'll respond to both Valerie, but also to Nick, because I think a lot. I think this kind of response can actually apply to both of what you've just said. You know, first, you know, you're right. We are here. The three co-sponsors of this resolution are students, and we do not have the bandwidth to do what a full-time staff is able to do. With that said, I don't necessarily think that means our ideas should be dismissed. As this was always envisioned, was a proposal to get this in motion with the nuts and the bolts and all that specific stuff to be sorted out by professionals at Cornell who do have the mandate and the resources to do this smartly and effectively. We're simply proposing a different way of thinking about a problem. And we do think it's a problem because we've heard feedback from lots of constituents around Cornell about the state of the waste infrastructure. So we certainly do not mean to suggest that we know better than the professionals hired by Cornell who have spent years and years studying these issues and working hard and diligently to address them. We're simply suggesting that there might be a different way to think about them. And to Nick's point, as you probably remember, when this resolution was first introduced back in November, there was some language in it that was a bit intemperate. That has since been removed. I believe it's very reasonably written right now. And we simply want to advance a proposal that we believe is the best for the Cornell community.
Thank you, Ian. We have Thomas next, and then Jake.
So I listened carefully to the recordings that you sent around, and I entered thinking, well, this could be a good idea. I don't know. And I, unfortunately, when I finished the recording, I wasn't convinced either way. My major piece of data that I would like to know isn't how many they have at Lehigh, but how long have they had them there and what has their experience been? And I have to say that over years of various kinds of situations, I've learned that salespeople are not always the best source for a full airing of the advantages and disadvantages of whatever it is they are selling. And that point was driven home when the salesperson started out saying there was a 75% operational savings with these big bellies, and by the time he finished, it had risen to 80% within a few minutes. So at the end of that recording, there was, I think it was a facilities guy, and maybe it's the person that Carolyn's talking about, said, oh, I'm going to call my colleagues at other universities and find out what their experience is. And I haven't heard anything about what may have emerged from that, other than perhaps Carolyn has talked to those people. So I finished the recording thinking, well, you guys are passionate about it. I don't know whether it's a good idea or not, so I will abstain. I can't support it as it is without knowing whether this really makes sense and achieves any of the goals you're talking about. And that is information that I talk about trust. I don't want to blame your sales guy, but I don't trust him, because I've dealt with a lot of salespeople. So I'd like to know what, if anything, came back from that. And it may have been what Carolyn was talking about when she spoke. I don't know. And that's all I have.
Does anyone like to respond?
Briefly in response to Thomas. So the 75 to 80% figure you're referring to, the language in the brochure they have says they, at the high end, they've experienced up to an 80% collection reduction.
Yeah, that's the company now.
This is Big Belly specifically.
I want to know what Lehigh said.
Yeah, I don't have that information, unfortunately. As far as the reaching out to other peer universities, that was Dan Scheid. I have not heard the report from his communications. If Caroline has, I would actually be curious to hear them as well, because I do think it would be relevant to this discussion.
How did it really work?
Thank you. I want to move to our next in the list here, James.
Yeah, so I was just going to start with, as Ian said, convenience is another, it's a main focus of this resolution, and it's deeply important to the student body itself, obviously. Probably not so much the sustainability council, but yeah, that's understandable, of course. And I just wanted to go back to something Caroline was saying. Her comments kind of suggest that the research has shown that the current system, you know, is working or is the best possible system. But it's clearly not, because so many students have voiced their desire for a change. And I mean, at least at the very least, greater convenience and, you know, a higher tech waste disposal system. And I think this resolution, the substantial support it's received from the student body versus, you know, the faculty and employees is kind of evidence of that. So considering the complaint and or about the current system, and I guess, you know, Caroline's desire for fewer trash cans, I think it raises the question, where does, like, the deference to old kind of outdated research by the Sustainability Council and, you know, ignorance of the student body's actual wishes, like, where does that deference end? Because if, you know, if we're just waiting for other schools to show that it works, we might be waiting a long time. I think as, you know, as one of the elite institutions in the country, why are we sitting on this issue amid actual complaints and concerns and waiting for other schools to kind of show us their evidence or their research? It seems like we're, like, taking a backseat, whereas we should be leading the way. Because we have a visible issue, we should take action. This is how the student body thinks it should be addressed best. Especially, I was saying earlier that, you know, disregarding the students' beliefs and wishes runs counter to an institution that claims to consider and heed the opinions and research of its student body. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to do that or to ignore those opinions, and just because employees are paid for the duty and, you know, so their opinion is taken with more deference, that doesn't make any sense to me. Especially considering that, in theory, some of the brightest, most innovative young minds in, you know, in the world and in the country are supposedly still or currently attending Cornell. So I think, you know, their desires and beliefs should be given more deference, or at least as much deference as the Sustainability Council itself.
Thank you, James. So next up, I have Annalie, and then Preston, Richard, and Jacob. Valerie, I believe your hand may still be up from the previous.
No, actually, I just put it up again.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. Annalie?
Yeah, my point isn't related to the resolution. Just like this idea that, like, students aren't, like, in this space to do this work, I think is really derogatory. And I feel like that counters the work that we do of shared governance. And I think that should be a conversation that we're thinking about, like, in this room. Last week, or what, 2 weeks ago, we were passing a resolution that had to do with an auditorium on campus. I can guess that most of the people in the Faculty Senate that came forward with that are not swim instructors, but that's still something that they're passionate about. And I think if students are passionate about this would be something that they're taking, that we're, as a university assembly, taking seriously. So just wanted to put that out there. We all come here on equal standings.
Thank you, Annalie. Move to Preston.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to motion to end debate and to call the question on the resolution.
We have a motion to call the question.
I'll second.
And we have a second. So now we are at the call the question. So with that, we will move into voting. For all those in favor of the resolution.
In favor of the call the question.
Yes, yes, in favor of the motion to call the question. Raise your placards or your hands on there.
Three online.
And those opposed?
Three in line, four in person.
And abstaining?
Seven.
So the motion to call the question did not pass at this time. So we'll continue our conversation, continue down my list here. Richard, you were up next.
Yeah, no, I'll be really brief. I agree with Tom. I've listened to everything, can't decide. I could ask for more evidence. I'm not sure that I'd decide even then. What strikes me, though, is that this, to vote this resolution down, is to end an exchange that I think is really serious and has been well conducted and well pursued. And that, I think it's a conversation that should continue. If the resolution passes, Cornell's not going to be forced to do anything. They'll be forced to respond to the resolution and to continue the conversation in that way. But so I'll vote for it, but I'm in Bond's camp. I mean, I also distrust vendors, which I think is, should be a natural instinct.
Next up, I have Jacob.
Yeah, so I want to, I think that the back and forth exchange has gotten a little bit personal, unnecessarily so. I want to, first of all, reiterate that whenever I make a claim, I am not making it towards the person's character. And that goes to the sustainability office. For any of you or anyone who we speak to, I know that I get extraordinarily passionate about certain things, and it might come off seeming perhaps a little bit personal, but it is not personal. It is all substantive. And the claim, to claim that the sustainability office has some sort of monetary special interest is not founded in anything substantive. It's merely a suspicion, but I'll leave it at that. I am, however, confident that technological innovation is the path toward a more sustainable future. I think that in order to have any sort of sustainable future, we've got to reground ourselves in reality and stop with this theoretical nonsense and start understanding the reality in which we all live. Yes, of course, it would be ideal if everyone ordered one Amazon package a month, if that, and combined them all. But that's just simply not the reality, the world in which we live in. And as a student, as a representative of the undergraduate student body, I'm proud to answer the calls for many of my fellow students for a cleaner, more efficient, more sustainable campus. I think that anybody who even questions the notion of whether or not students should have a voice in shared governance perhaps forgot that they're at an academic institution. And maybe ought to reevaluate that statement. And I will not take that statement personally, though, as I had mentioned before. But I would like to make a motion to table the resolution because I think that there still is a lot more data outstanding that needs to be done. And I don't want to rush a resolution for the sake of getting it passed. I want to ensure that we have a resolution that actually has substance. And so for that reason, I'm going to make the motion to table the resolution, send it back to the committee and answer some of the questions that Thomas and Richard have raised and try to work with the sustainability office. And I invite all of those who are perhaps hesitant to support us or have stated today that they're not going to support us to work with us in kind of fleshing out this resolution to build something that we can all be proud of and vote for that will really remedy the problems that we see. Because I think that the problems are all recognized amongst us. I think it's how we solve those problems is where we disagree. So I'd like to make a motion to table the resolution and send it back to the committee.
I have a motion to table. Do we have a second?
Can I say something before we table that, Jacob?
Sure.
I'll go ahead, Duncan.
Thank you. I'll continue to support that tabling. Just briefly before we end discussion on this and move on, I feel like it's worth acknowledging, yes, we are three students working on this, but we are bringing this to the University Assembly because we want to have these conversations. Right. We're welcoming these kind of objections. If there's an issue with research, we've worked on this since November. We want to hear what the issue with the research is. Mm-hmm. If there's an issue with Sustainability Cornell, there's a reason we keep returning to Sustainability Cornell. But please, please, please don't disregard what's a concern to a lot of students because of an issue that students are working on this. Please don't disregard an issue to sustainability because there's a disagreement on the practical applications of how we try and support Cornell. We've tried to bring facts, we've tried to bring beyond just our personal opinions and beliefs on other community members and people we work for and people we admire, even if we disagree with them. And I hope we can expect the same from everyone else.
Thank you. We have a motion to table.
Can I please say something? Because, I mean, clearly some of these comments are addressed to me. So I just want to make it clear, guys. I didn't mean to make it sound like I am putting you guys down because you're students. I understand, that everybody has a voice in this. I appreciate the resolution, and I don't think you understood what I was saying, which was I don't know that this big belly solution, these receptacles, are the way to go. I think you're missing the bigger issue, which is looking at this thing as a whole study. So I think all of us, you guys and the sustainability you know, office can work together on a resolution that works for everybody. So I don't think it's a question of me not taking you guys seriously because you're students, or me taking them more seriously because they're employees. It's a question of you're missing the bigger picture here. This is just one. I'm dropping the bucket now. I have no idea what the Amazon boxes issue is, because, I mean, that's way outside of my purview. But as I understand it, from a waste receptacle, we're not just talking about the main campus here. We're talking about Cornell as a whole, right? So it's not just what's going on in the main campus. We're talking about Geneva. We're talking about the vet school. We're talking about any of the environments around Cornell. So think about the bigger issue as a whole, not just, you know, what we're doing on the main campus here, because that's really what the resolution should be about. I don't think you should get rid of the resolution. I think you should figure out how to rework it. So I support the tabling. Thank you.
So Valerie, is that a second on the motion to table?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, we have Valerie seconded the motion to table. With that, all those in favor of tabling the resolution, raise your placards or your hands on Zoom. And those opposed? And abstain. So where are we standing right now?
10 to 8.
That would put us as the majority has voted in favor, correct?
Yes.
Okay, then I will abstain. All right, with that, the motion to table passes. I want to thank the assembly for the dialogue and the response and the respectfulness and being able to address things as they get heated, as conversations and topics come up. I think this is exactly what we are here to do, and I greatly appreciate everyone's participation in that. With that, we're going to move on to our new business here, starting here with resolution number 6, alterations to the codes and judicial committee name and function. With that, I'll just turn it over to James.
Thank you. So essentially, this resolution comprises two main changes. So there's a functional change to CJC, and then there's also going to be a name change. I'm going to explain the functional change first, because hopefully the name change will make more sense in light of these functional changes. So regarding the functional changes, the two main functions of the CJC under the old campus code of conduct can be summarized as being the monitor of the UHRB appointment process and reviewing new UA resolutions before they can be or could be advanced to the UA core vote. And both of these functions have been phased out by the new code. The monitoring function with regard to the UHRP is now delegated to the director of the OSCCS, the executive committees, and the assemblies and Senate. And as far as the resolution review function, the CJC isn't tasked any longer with mandatory review of resolutions, because the new code, campus code of conduct, is a student code of conduct, so it doesn't make any sense to have a body, CJC, with, you know, it doesn't just comprise students. It's made up of several different constituencies, so it wouldn't have make any sense to have the CJC review each resolution. So in changing or in clarifying the CJC's new role and new name under the new student code of conduct, basically, what we try to do is retain the essence of these two functions, but within the contours of the new code. So going into it, as far as the monitoring function of the UHRP appointment process, this function can, I guess, be retained or modified under the new code by kind of incorporating the duties or functions that I performed late last summer and early this school year, and kind of formalizing them. So essentially, the appointment process is that the assemblies and Senate solicit applications from the campus body, which are then submitted to the executive committees, who then approve nominees and submit them to the director of the OSCCS for approval or ratification. Pretty much right. So in this process, there are a few different gray areas. Basically, you know, who communicates the timeline and number of appointees that are needed, who communicates the outcomes of any default or deficiency in the required number of appointees. And importantly, what application to use, what questions to ask of applicants, things like that. And in theory, the OSCCS could itself kind of, you know, instruct the assemblies and Senate on how to go about that. but our concern is that it can seem kind of heavy-handed or almost be construed like a mandate. So our thinking is that we need a neutral party with constituents from several campus populations to provide that guidance so that it's kind of a, you know, a neutral go-between, which is what I did last year. But we phrased it so that the CJC, currently called, is really only available available for guidance. Not, you know, it's not a mandatory instructional function. Basically, how we're thinking it will work is that, as happened last year, the you know, the for example, the GPSA, if they're unsure about how to solicit a point or applications from the student body, can reach out to the CJC and we can provide them with previous applications. We can clarify the timeline and then the outcome in case of any default and things like that. So yeah, it's basically a, it's, you know, it's not a mandate. It's a, it's a optional guidance function if they should so request it. As far as the review function, obviously, like I said, it doesn't make any sense to have the CJC, which is made up of non-students and students, to ratify, you know, resolutions that pertain only to students. So that, you know, that can't be our role anymore. But last year, I know there was a lot of concern, especially amongst the student population, that basically reducing a campus code of conduct to a student code of conduct would kind of remove the ability of a neutral body or a body affiliated with students to ensure that there's kind of uniform application of the code and its, you know, its values and behavioral standards. You know, to make sure those are applied evenly, not just to students, but to faculty and employees as well. And obviously there are instances where, because of the different nature of students and, you know, professional students, employees and faculty and whatnot, there is, you know, it makes sense to have kind of discrepant treatment between the, you know, between the different groups. But I think that's basically where we see the CJC kind of addressing this that issue. So what we're thinking is, and if you read the resolution, essentially we would implement, the CJC would become essentially a body to receive any complaints about kind of discrepant treatment or a discrepant application of the behavioral standards of Cornell, you know, to the entire Cornell population. So basically, if there are any instances where the values or the standards of the student code of conduct kind of were being disregarded when applied to different constituencies on campus, and there are several instances of this over the past couple years, we would be the body to receive those complaints, discuss them in, you know, in committee, and then bring them as appropriate, bring them forth in at a university assembly meeting for discussion and possibly, you know, for either resolution or to be addressed in an, you know, an actual resolution. So that's basically the thought process behind retaining the review function. And then moving on to the name change, or should I open it to questions for that aspect of the review?
Oh, no, if you want to close out.
Okay. All right, yeah, so regarding the name change, super simple, just in light of what I've already discussed, obviously, the CJC stands for Codes and Judicial Committee, which doesn't make any sense under the new Student Code of Conduct, because we've kind of gotten away from a judicial process, and we're more interested in kind of a more inclusive adjudicatory hearing and a hearing process rather than a judicial process. So the name Codes and Judicial Committee doesn't make any sense anymore, especially in light of the you know, removal of the old functions of the committee. So what we propose is to change the name of CJC to the Campus Codes and Conduct Committee, which would be the CCCC, or we're thinking the 4C, any, you know, whatever rolls off the tongue easiest. But yeah, Campus Codes and Conduct Committee, and that's that.
Well, thank you very much, James, to you and to the current CJC for their work here. Just a reminder to folks on resolutions, we will have a discussion here today, and we won't be voting on the resolution. Allows opportunity for James and the committee to hear feedback. One thing I know that we've heard already from the Office of the Assemblies is references to bylaws need to include specific lines and documentation, which can easily be adapted as James takes this resolution and hears feedback from folks. So with that, I'll open up to the floor. Any questions or comments? Okay, James, and bless you.
Sorry.
What's on?
If there's nothing, a motion to table.
We have a motion to table. Do we have a second?
Second.
Do we have a second? All those in favor of tabling the motion, or tabling that resolution, raise your placards. Those opposed? And abstentions? Right. With that, the motion to table passes. Yeah, got off a lot easier than these.
Yeah.
But I do encourage folks to give feedback to James, and please look at the things stated here. Provide perspective and feedback for James so that the resolution can come back with that taken into account. All right, with that, we'll move on to our next item here, resolution number 7, establishing the first Tuesday in November each year as election day of Cornell University recognized civic holiday. And I'll turn it over to you, Jacob, as the sponsor.
Yeah, so this is brought to the assembly on behalf of Patrick Mailer, who is the current Oliver person in the Ithaca Common Council, a friend of mine and some other members of the assembly. And he has been working, and he's also a student here, he's a junior. I'm not sure if anybody caught him on Wheel of Fortune last night, but he was on there, and he just made his ability to pay for Cornell a little bit easier. No, Wheel of Fortune.
Means something on Jeopardy and on Wheel of Fortune?
I know, we're dominating the game.
Wow, okay. He won what? I'm sorry.
So, 1.5 big bills. That's right. Maybe you can ship it. No, so we'll bring him as a celebrity here in a few weeks. But no, he has been working at Cornell as I believe he's self-appointed himself the civic champion of Cornell. He's the former head of Cornell Votes before he accepted the position on the Common Council, and he's working to try to increase the democratic participation of students. And so in doing that, he came to myself and Duncan in interest to create a resolution that would establish the first Tuesday in November of each year, Federal Election Day, as a Cornell University recognized holiday, the Cornell University Civic Holiday, giving students, faculty, and campus employees off in order to allow them to go vote.
I can add something briefly as well.
Yes,
go ahead. Sponsors. I would like to cede most of my time to Isaac Chasen, who is here on behalf of Cornell Votes. He's also the SA's head of elections.
Director.
I just want to highlight that this is just kind of in personally for me, in recognition of kind of the necessity of supporting just general democratic participation in academic institutions. I think this is a perfect example of how we can kind of give Cornell students, faculty, staff, graduate and professional students an opportunity to participate in the wider community around them, not just to vote, but also to take a day maybe to do some other civil service. And recognizing the importance of that, I think nowadays is more important than ever. I'd love to give Isaac a chance to speak.
Yeah, go ahead, Isaac.
Thank you, Duncan. And hi, everyone. For those I haven't met, my name is Isaac Chasen. I'm an undergrad junior in the Dyson School. I'm the SA's Director of Elections and a member of the Executive Board of Cornell Votes. Just to go a bit deeper into the civic holiday, the whereas are fairly straightforward. Cornell students, faculty, and staff have become more engaged in the democratic process over the last couple of years. Efforts by Cornell Votes, which is only 2 years old as of now, through partnerships with the university administration, the Einhorn Center, previously the Public Service Center, and other stakeholders, have increased voter turnout at Cornell by nearly 20%, pushing it to above the national average of all universities. So basically what we're proposing is a Cornell civic holiday, in which the first Tuesday first Tuesday in November every year is both a day off from classes for students and also a day off for employees as well. Employees who choose to work would receive 2.5 times pay. I want to emphasize that peer institutions, including Columbia, Stanford, and Brown, have enacted similar days of service on Election Day. And I want to emphasize that this holiday would, or this civic holiday would be meant to be a day of service, really, both to increase the availability and accessibility of getting to the polls for students, and also to facilitate opportunities for civic engagement for students not eligible to vote in our federal elections. And this can take place in many different factions. We'd love to see what ideas faculty employees have for civic engagement opportunities. We discussed this with the Student Assembly just recently, and the potential of forming committees to look into potential opportunities for civic engagement that could culminate in this day. That's basically all. And just one more thing. We hope to pass this resolution through all the governing bodies at Cornell and hope to see this take effect on Election Day 2024. And with that, I'll give the rest of my time back to Duncan and Jake.
Thank you very much. And we're kind of close on time. I would entertain a motion to extend for this evening. Mr. Jacob?
Yep, I'd like to make a motion to extend for 15 minutes.
Second. With a second for 15. All right.
Beginning at 6 o'clock p.m.
Yes. All those, any opposition to the extension? Seeing none, the meeting is extended to 6:15. I'll open the floor to comments for the resolution.
So I was a political science major as an undergrad. So I'd just like to give the counterpoint to making Election Day a civic holiday. And the thought process is that making it, not having a civic holiday is basically serving a filtering function, and it's that the better informed members of society, because they're better informed and because they've taken it upon themselves to inform themselves, they're more likely to make it to, the ballot box on Election Day. And whereas if we're just kind of making it go out and vote for the entire student population, that's just encouraging kind of uninformed voting, or voting because it's a holiday and because it's just a college celeb, as it were. So yeah, I just like to point that out.
Yeah, I would just like to say that that's really classist. A lot of people don't have the opportunity to just leave work, especially when we're thinking about employees and thinking about students, to go vote. I'd also say that a lot of times that like disproportionately impacts marginalized people who can't make it to the polls. So I would just like to say that, I don't want to say to disregard that, but I would say to like think of that, that argument as a government major as well, to understand that like not everyone has access to this, and like I think that like there are like legitimate reasons why you wouldn't necessarily want a civic holiday, but I think that we should consider that not everyone has the same opportunities to make it to the polls that others do.
Thank you, Emily. I believe James, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, I'm struggling to see how it's a classist issue. As far as I know, the upper classes are employed just as frequently or commonly as the lower classes, maybe even more so. I don't necessarily agree with that argument. But as far as, people might not have the ability, elections are specifically timed and made so that everyone technically has the opportunity to vote. Like, it might not be as easy, but my point is that in theory, the more informed people are, better informed people are more likely to make that extra effort to incorporate voting into their normal work life, which is, for students, it's not a huge ask. Like, we can go there in between classes, and if transportation's an issue, then the resolution could be limited to that. But as far as making it a holiday, I think it's kind of an extreme job.
Okay, then I'll and then we'll move on to another subject.
Yeah, just like that idea that wealthy people are employed at the same rates as people who aren't as wealthy. I'm just not even going to engage with that, but I would like to like mention the fact that like when we're thinking about this and considering that, people who have more job flexibility are usually wealthier people. And I think when we're thinking about this conversation, it's like understanding who gets to dictate like their schedules and their work time and stuff like that. And we should be giving people the opportunity to make it to the polls to vote. I also think that like if we're giving people this civic holiday, and they're taking advantage of the opportunity to vote, like we should be encouraging them to do so as a university that educates citizens.
Thank you. And now I'll move to Marcy and then to.
Can I respond just briefly to this as one of the co-sponsors?
I'd like to get to Marcy and then we'll come back to you.
So one thing, New York State does give employees 2 hours to vote. So perhaps thinking about making it I mean, I appreciate enough of the work that went into this, and I do think, you know, definitely people should have time to vote. And perhaps just making the student portion, you know, making it, you know, no classes that day. On the other hand, how many people do live and vote? Like, you're going to vote in Ithaca. So are you registered in Ithaca? I don't know. But many people who go to Cornell don't necessarily live in Ithaca and are registered to vote in Ithaca. That's just a thought, too.
Thank you, Marcy. Okay.
I'll touch on that point briefly. Again, this is also, it's a civic holiday, recognizing it's beyond just, you know, international students, for example, Isaac brought up, it's a small portion of students on this campus. There's obviously other students who have different registration statuses, but the point of this really is to give an opportunity just to make voting more accessible, and also to increase opportunities for people who maybe haven't considered it because they have class or, and they're between project teams and whatever issues they could have that could affect their ability to get to the polls. In Ithaca, having a day off could answer numerous amounts of those concerns, and specifically towards like the 2 hour employment get. A lot of students don't necessarily have that luxury for whatever reason. Maybe they're the club or something or a team, or, you know, I was thinking of the student athlete who maybe also really is passionate about a job application they're working on. All of a sudden, 12 hours goes by like that and the polls are closed. This is really just recognizing that there's one small barrier we could clear here that could help a lot of people get registered to vote. And specifically on the back and forth, I appreciate the constructive perspective here. I disagree with it, to be fully honest, on a couple levels. But really, what I think kind of James going about this that could be helpful is just acknowledging that this is really just to focus on how we can give more Cornell students, people who are, if you bring up the point of education, if you bring up the point of ability to stay up on political topics or whatnot, more access to vote. You know, if there's a concern that, you know, people should be able to know about these things and should be able to keep up on these things, I don't think that's necessarily a question here in Cornell's community. I think the question is more of how we find time in our day to participate in things like this, participate in civic actions like voting. And so I think your concern, well, I try to understand where you're coming from. I don't entirely agree with it. I also don't think it applies directly to this resolution. So I respectfully disagree with that.
Thank you, Duncan. And over to Valerie next.
I'm neutral on this one way or the other, but I was curious, don't we have early voting still? Or is this, because I know when the last election rolled around, I voted early. So, you know, I don't know, does the students not have access to early voting as well, or?
Yeah. Well, you have access to early voting if you're a registered voter in the United States. I mean, it, depending on where you live, that might be more or less accessible to you. You know, if you live in Ithaca, that'll be easy. If you live in California, that might be more difficult. I'm not sure if California has a mail-in voting. It does have mail-in early voting, but maybe Oregon doesn't. So it might be a little bit different. I think that that is an interesting point that you raised, though, and I think that ultimately and Isaac, please correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, the ultimate goal of this resolution is really to make sure that our community members have the opportunity to go vote. And engaging in rhetoric that is gatekeeping, who can, who should go vote, is dangerous. It harkens back to a really dark time where we set standards as to who we thought were intelligent enough to go vote. It's nonsense. It's absurd. And I know that you probably are engaged in a lot of different misinformation campaigns, and that's where you come up with these lunacy theories, but they're not grounded in any sort of
David, can I ask for any quorum, please?
Were you in my undergrad institution?
I'd like to ask.
No, I wasn't, actually. I went here.
All right.
I
don't my God. Example,
but I'm going to ask for a quorum here to limit your responses to those that are constructive and not attacked. So I do want to recognize now Richard.
Yeah, so some places do have holidays for elections, and they do become kind of civic celebrations. And I've studied them in the 19th century, and they were almost like festivals of polls. A lot of drinking, a lot of bribery, a lot of other stuff. They were exciting, but they were exercises in democracy. So I can, but you know, our modern polls aren't like that. I mean, they're like mausoleums. You go and everybody's quiet.
or not experience that people like or enjoy it as much. I would make two points. One is I don't like multiplying holidays as opposed to the veterans one for the same reason. I'd like to see some kind of trade-off. So if we're going to have election, national election, be a holiday, I'd like to say, see some holiday taken off the table. So what would you do? Which one would you eliminate? That would be one kind of question. The second one is, you know, I think we're possibly overestimating the barriers to voting. I kind of think that if you had incentives, if you paid somebody, anyone, $5 to go to the polls, they wouldn't need all day to do it. You just do it. It's like $5. It's they. In other words, we're looking at something where the solution doesn't quite fit with what I see. That's not a problem, but with the situation, I'm reluctant to make this an additional holiday. But if you want to take one off the table, another one off the table, yeah, then I'd be. We're a little bit like Catholics in the Middle Ages. You know, they kept multiplying holidays because everybody worked too hard. So pretty soon, you know, half the calendar was a religious holiday of some sort. We're not quite there yet, but this notion that holidays are a quick fix, not too soon.
Thank you, Richard. Any other comments?
Could I just respond to that?
Yeah, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, go ahead, Isaac.
All right, well, thank you all for your points thus far. In response to your point, Richard, whether it's adding a Tuesday or Thursday, you know, to the beginning or the end of the semester, we want to make sure if this eventually does come to fruition that this doesn't mess with the balance of classes of Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Tuesday, Thursday classes. And in response to some earlier points, you know, I would like to think that the only barrier to voting is knowledge base. But unfortunately, it's not. You know, barriers to voting, you know, take many forms, whether it's, you know, whether it's prior commitments, whether it's classes, whether it's jobs after, you know, work study programs, whether it's jobs after classes, to the point where, you know, whether it's faculty, staff, or students just simply don't have the time of day to get to the polls. You know, and I want to also emphasize that this is, you know, we don't want to frame this as a day off. We want to frame this as a day of service, whether that's providing opportunities that are university sponsored, that are faculty sponsored, whether employee sponsored, whether it's, you know, through residential buildings or through colleges, for folks to engage in service that's both, you know, related to their field of study or, you know, to the broader area of civic engagement in our democracy. So that's, you know, obviously I can't make anyone frame the debate that way, but I think, you know, that's how I would really appreciate it if this resolution were framed as an opportunity for civic engagement service.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I just wanted to state that I was providing the counterpoint, not necessarily even endorsing it, but now that we've started with ad hominem attacks, I'll just defend my point. Which was that I think Richard's the only one who got it, was that it's not very hard to mail in a ballot, to prepare beforehand. The population most likely in our society to do so are the better informed. Are we trying to get the entire population of the United States to vote, whether or not they're informed, whether or not they even know who's running in the election? I think the vast majority of students actually don't, believe it or not. And I think just making it a holiday and busing students to the ballots is not helping the democratic process at all. I mean, assuming we lived in like Jim Crow times, then yeah, we should remove all restrictions to voting. But like having people go about their daily lives, their normal daily lives, and then after work or at their lunch break or on their 2-hour break, spending 20, 30 minutes to go vote, that doesn't warrant an entire day off. Like, you completely missed my point, to be honest. But thanks for the lunatic comment.
Go ahead. Oh.
Yeah, I'm just going to remind everyone, this is a resolution on adding a civic holiday focused on giving Cornell students and Cornell faculty and staff and undergraduate grant professional students, you've all heard about this before, a chance to make voting more accessible, give them an opportunity to participate closer with the community and take up issues or service they believe are fit. Modeled after peer institutes like Columbia and Stanford, in recognition that Cornell students have above national average interest in voting, and I think you can read the resolution from there. If there's any comments on that, I'd love to hear it. If there's comments on really the structure of this or possible problems that could come up with getting a day off or the benefits of getting students to vote or just the overall like life lessons we can teach people about this that are included in the resolution, I think that makes total sense. I just think for right now, a lot of this is straying far from the resolution. And I'd like to reiterate what Isaac, myself, and Representative Fite started this with, which is trying to make voting more accessible for people at Cornell through this civic holiday of service.
Thank you very much. Well said, Duncan, and I echo your sentiments that the conversation is around the resolution, and do want to acknowledge that we have strayed a bit from what I would consider constructive conversation here, and ask that we provide feedback to those who have brought forth the resolution to help them to strengthen and grow it. With that, I would entertain a motion to table the resolution so that it can be continued to work on.
I'd like to table. I make a motion to table the resolution.
Second.
Seconded. Motion by David and seconded by Duncan. All those in favor of tabling the resolution, raise your placards or your Zoom hands. Any opposed? And abstentions? All right, with that, the motion is tabled. And again, encourage folks that we had a lot of topics covered today, so please provide those topics. I would just ask if we do have a meeting next week. So as we go to these reports, please know that you'll have another one next week. We'll try to make sure we have a little bit more time for the Assembly and Senate reports. But I will give everyone an opportunity if there's something pressing. So we'll start with the Student Assembly.
Yeah, I was just going to motion to extend time since we're at 6:15.
Motion to extend and second it. Any opposition? All right. And opposition?
So is that?
Well, if there is opposition, then we can vote on the motion. So all those in favor of motion of extending 10 minutes, raise your placards and hands.
That's four up there.
And those opposed? And abstentions? On this one too. All right, so that the motion doesn't pass, the meeting will adjourn at 6:15. So we had a heated conversation, a lot of things to cover today. I apologize that our assemblies and senate didn't get a chance to report out. We do have next week. We're meeting 2 weeks in a row. So thank you all for your time and engagement, and encourage you all to have civil discourse and conversation in between now and next week meeting, which we can bring some of these things back. We will likely not bring all of them back, but we'll see what we have. With that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Jacob?
Motion
to adjourn. Do you have a second? Seconded by Eve. Any opposed? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.